For Aurore, who was born this year, and for all those who once were babies. Begin by making a more careful study of your pupils, for it is clear that you know nothing about them. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Emile, or On Education, 1762. This is a strange and amazing fact. We know every nook and cranny of the human body. We have cataloged every animal on the planet. We have described and baptized every blade of grass. But we have left psychological techniques to their empiricism for centuries, as if they were of lesser importance than those of the healer, the breeder, or the farmer. Jean Piaget, La Pédagogie Moderne, 1949. If we don't know how we learn, how on earth do we know how to teach? L. Raphael Reif, President of MIT, March 23, 2017. Introduction. In September 2009, an extraordinary child forced me to drastically revise my ideas about learning. I was visiting the Sara Hospital in Brasilia, a neurological rehabilitation center with a white architecture inspired by Oscar Niemeyer, with which my laboratory has collaborated for about 10 years. The director, Lucia Braga, asked me to meet one of her patients, Felipe, a young boy only 7 years old, who had spent more than half his life in a hospital bed. She explained to me how, at the age of 4, he had been shot in the street. Unfortunately, not such a rare event in Brazil. The stray bullet had severed his spinal cord, thus rendering him almost completely paralyzed, tetraparetic. It also destroyed the visual areas of his brain. He was fully blind. To help him breathe, an opening was made in his trachea at the base of his neck, and for over 3 years, he had been living in a hospital room, locked within the coffin of his inert body. In the corridor leading to his room, I remember bracing myself at the thought of having to face a broken child. And then I meet Felipe, a lovely little boy like any other 7-year-old, talkative, full of life, and curious about everything. He speaks flawlessly with an extensive vocabulary and asks me mischievous questions about French words. I learned that he has always been passionate about languages and never misses an opportunity to enrich his trilingual vocabulary. He speaks Portuguese, English, and Spanish. Although he is blind and bedridden, he escapes into his imagination by writing his own novels, and the hospital team has encouraged him in this path. In a few months, he learned to dictate his stories to an assistant, then write them himself using a special keyboard connected to a computer and sound card. The pediatricians and speech therapists take turns at his bedside, transforming his writings into real, tactile books with embossed illustrations that he proudly sweeps with his fingers, using the little sense of touch that he has left. His stories speak of heroes and heroines, mountains and lakes that he will never see, but that he dreams of like any other little boy. Meeting with Felipe deeply moved me and also persuaded me to take a closer look at what is probably the greatest talent of our brain, the ability to learn. Here was a child whose very existence poses a challenge to neuroscience. How do our brain's cognitive faculties resist such a radical upheaval of their environment? Why could Felipe and I share the same thoughts, given our extraordinarily different sensory experiences? How do different human brains converge on the same concepts, almost regardless of how and when they learn them? Many neuroscientists are empiricists. Together with the English Enlightenment philosopher John Locke, 1632 to 1704, they presume that the brain simply draws its knowledge from its environment. In this view, the main property of cortical circuits is their plasticity, their ability to adapt to their inputs. And indeed, nerve cells possess a remarkable ability to constantly adjust their synapses according to the signals they receive. Yet, if this were the brain's main drive, my little Felipe